creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Heather Rogers is the author of The Hidden Life of Garbage, which happens to be the 2010-2011 Common Book for Winona State University. Rogers was visiting Winona State and during her stay participated in a panel discussion entitled Reducing the Waste Stream. Others in the panel included Ann Morse, Sustainability Coordinator for Winona County Environmental Services, Farah Boers Parsi, Professor of Composite Materials Engineering, and Dave Matthews, Store Manager for the Walmart store in Winona. This week on Culture Click, as you may have guessed it, we're talking trash with the culture of garbage. We now go to our host, Elizabeth Hayes, as she brings up the first topic of discussion.
Thank you for coming today to our panel discussion and for supporting the Common Book Project at Winona State. So thank you all for coming. I'll throw out the first question. Your book, Heather, is all about garbage, obviously, and not only about what we do with garbage, but why it is that we have so much. And you make the case that a lot of it comes in the form of packaging. And I have to say, as someone who buys consumer items, I have struggled opening toys. There's so much packaging in them. I've struggled opening cucumbers that are wrapped up in packaging and more packaging. So it seems like no matter where you go, the grocery aisle, the toys, electronics, there is quite a bit of packaging, to my mind at least. And I'm wondering, is it excessive? Do we really have too much? Do we need it? And what's driving all this packaging anyway? So whoever would like to take that one, we'll start things off and love to hear from all of you.
Well, basically some of the things we're doing at Walmart is something that President Clinton started back on September 26th of 2007. We're changing the way we package. Like our detergent is all concentrate now to reduce the amount of plastic used. The iPods now, some of our iPads and other electronics are used with small condensed cardboard versus big bulky things. The actual products themselves are small, so we're trying to reduce the product and stuff that we use so we can recycle everything are some of the things we're doing at the store level.
I guess what I've written about and the research that I've done to answer the question of why do we have so much packaging, I mean, there's a number of reasons why. One of them, and why we have so much packaging and, you know, by extension, why do we have so much waste? One of the reasons is that whenever you buy a product, you're also paying for the packaging. And that's something that's very easy to forget because we sort of relegated packaging to its own, you know, sort of special category. And it's a commodity just like the iPod that you buy. It might seem like it's not, but it is. And so it's a way of creating consumption. It's another form of consumption. And I'm just going to tell a brief story about how it came about in its current incarnation. In the 1950s, there was a potential crisis after World War II, right? We had a huge booming economy when, after the war, the U.S. produced four-fifths of the world's goods. And by the late 1950s, most Americans had a car, a house, all the appliances they needed, and there was this potential for consumption to radically decline. Germany and Japan had their production manufacturing capabilities were up and running by that point, so they were competing with the United States. So this potential crisis for what could be called overproduction created a panic in U.S. manufacturers. And at that point, they embraced the idea of built-in obsolescence, which is to, the idea behind that is to design products that wear out faster than they need to or go out of fashion. And the idea being that if you could create things that wore out more quickly, you could stoke consumption. And so that's what happened. And packaging is part of that. It wasn't until that point that we really started seeing packaging as we know it today.
We are. When I said we, it doesn't mean we here. This is a global issue. You can go to other countries and same thing. We struggle here. It's all over. I've been to places that we can never think of, and it's still these issues are there. Places in the mountains that you can never think of. You know, these people don't even know about plastic. So it's probably plastic piled up right there. We are a consumer society. The very first thing I hear in the news is what is our consumer index for a month. So that's kind of one issue that we are encouraged to consume. For whatever reason, it provides jobs, right? So that's one thing I want to keep in mind. And we also throw away too much. When you consume that much, you throw it away. Okay? If you read the book, 80% of what gets bought gets thrown away. 80%. So these are 2 points. The third one is an issue of supply and demand. That is the economics that runs everything. If you want it, no, it's there, I'm going to get it. That's the third one. On the other hand, I myself, I don't want to go back and live like 150 years ago. That doesn't mean we didn't have garbage 150 years ago. We have a lifestyle that we like. If you look around and look at everything that you see around here and see what is it made of, that tells you we like a lot of stuff. Okay, I'm wearing a fleece, okay, which I have probably about 3-4 of these, and I wear them all the time. And I enjoy wearing this polyester fleece, and it's comfortable. And so it's not like, you know, that certain materials have caused this problem. It's our behavior that has caused that. So we kind of need to find a solution to see, okay, what are we going to do to change some of the behavior, and how do we use these materials? So it's not just packaging. I mean, you start with packaging, the issue is a lot bigger than just packaging.
And I am going to agree with the previous speakers. I do think that it is our consumption that is driving the waste, really. I will say that it's convenience. Madison Avenue has decided that that's what we want. And we have said, yep, that's exactly what we want because that's what we've been buying. Yet, as we see more of the consequences of the waste, and we actually have an opportunity to visit it in our classes and, you know, talk about it, it seems pretty horrific. And I think people are interested in seeing some opportunities to move away from that. And I want to say that there are opportunities for you to change your behavior. And you'll know one of them. I'm going to back up and say that I think we're all in agreement that what you learned in kindergarten is still the rule in terms of material consumption and its reuse, or reduce, reuse, and recycle in that order. And so when we are now given much greater opportunity to buy inexpensive reusable shopping bags for a dollar a piece, I think a lot of us are doing it, and I do it invariably all the time, and I actually invest in some bags that are really beautiful and artistic, so every time I go grocery shopping, I really get a kick out of my bags, and even the baggers say, these are great, you know, they really like them because they're super durable, and I want to back up and say, they're made of plastic, and I'm not a person that says that there isn't a rule for plastics, because I think there are. But they're very specific. And in this case, I use a woven polypropylene bag that's super durable. I will give that to my daughter when I'm finished with them. And you can wash them easily. They're just the perfect thing for grocery bags. So we don't have to cut down trees, and we don't have to have the film bags that cause such a disaster in our waterways and in our trees and make things look such a mess. So there are opportunities like that that I think we really need to focus on, because there are real savings, savings that you will see, and then savings that are kind of invisible to us, unless we're kind of policymakers and we make it our life's work to see, so that something like every ton of garbage that you guys set out at the curb, you throw away, which is, I think, what most of us are thinking of, there is 7 tons of material that's wasted that goes into the production of that ton of packaging. So it's really 8 tons when you see one. So that's it for the first question.
Well, just to follow up on that, even if I bring my own bags to the store, I'm still taking home with me my own bags filled with bags containing other things. And I guess I'm wondering, and maybe this is a question for you, for the retail side, what is it going to take to reduce waste at the front end? I don't know. Does Walmart really want all those items to arrive in so much packaging, or is it being driven by the manufacturers? Or how can we get that reduction to happen, you know, really at the front end?
Well, like she said, that we do offer those reusable bags. We have even freezer bags now that keep things hot and cold. We offer those at all of our checkouts, at all of our stores. We also have them back in our freezer departments for the freezer and heater bags. Our cashiers, for the most part, ask if they'd like it to be bagged, because some people bring their own bags at home, which we gladly abide by if they want that. At our front entrances on the GM and our grocery side, we have boxes for customers, so they take plastic bags, they can bring the used ones back, either reuse them, or we have big boxes where we can drop them in, and then we recycle them and reuse them, and I know we ship them back to our DCs to be reused and refurbished for our plastics.
I guess I'm thinking of things like, you know, the clothes that arrive at the store come, apparently, I'm told, not just at Walmart, but all retailers individually wrapped, you know, each blouse, you know, it's somebody's job to de-junk, it's called, take all that packaging that the consumer never even sees and throw it out. What can be done, and for any of you, if you have an answer here, to reduce that packaging that's really hidden from even the consumer, that happens way early in the process? Do we need all that or not?
I would like to say that there are some retailers who are working very hard at that, and Target is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think Walmart, too, is looking at that kind of thing, where one of the things that I do every year is track the amount of recyclables that are actually generated within Winona County. So I go to Walmart and get the numbers, and I go to Target, and I've seen those numbers drop because they truly are getting their... It used to be that every one of them was wrapped in a film bag, but now they don't. They come folded, and there's so much that's reusable within Target. So they are like truly a model of the packaging waste reduction. And so for those companies that are trying to be sustainable, and there are a number of models, they're out there. And I would encourage people to communicate with their retailer, their favorite retailer, and ask them about that, because there's nothing like the power of the consumer to put the pressure on them, because they will report that to their upper management.
I can kind of answer that from a little bit kind of pseudo-technical point of view. For example, this bottle right here, I don't use it. I always fight with my daughter because she goes and grabs some stuff for picnic and stuff. If you read the label right here, this bottle is 23.7% less plastic. It's a little flimsy, okay, but it still works. It's for water. This is a good solution, that from the last generation to this generation, you're using 23.7% less plastic. Assuming that you want to use this bottle, okay, I'm not encouraging that. What I do myself is, this is what I do. Okay, I take this home, this is plastic. I take it home, fill it up, bring it back, I use it, and I do this once a week. Okay? That's my behavior change, okay, for somebody who's teaching this stuff. This is one example. This is another one. This is probably the most highly engineered item in this room. Okay? This holds a lot of pressure, and this cap right here, if you think about what this cap does, this is pretty highly engineered. And something like this, they've been able to reduce it by 5%. Okay? Think about the volume that could be saved by reduction, okay, of the material that you use by 5%. These are solutions that this is not a bad way to go, to start going in a direction to use less and less and less, and on the same hand, you know, change your behavior. Then we arrive at somewhere that is probably feel comfortable than where we are today.
I'm just curious, what is it about the cap that's so...
The cap holds 10 atmosphere of pressure. I think that's what the pressure inside of CO2 is. So when you buy your Coke, you still have gas in there, yeah, and it's sitting on the shelf for 2-3 months. Yeah.
What do they have to do? I'm sorry, this is totally... But what do they have to do to the cap to make it... I mean, is it just... Because I look at it, I just think plastic.
I don't work for Coke, so plastic. I don't know exactly what they do. I know that that's... They claim that this is using less material.
I think this is probably propylene.
So...
Yeah. Okay. What I would say about Faribault's demonstration with these different products is that not only is it a change of behavior, of his behavior, filling up the jug, but it's also a change, the manufacturers, and as Anne was saying, the retailers are making different choices. And those are the kinds of things that will start to truly affect a reduction, is the changes in production and manufacturing. And not just the changes that you and I make as individuals, because the choices that I can make, like I want to be able to buy my beverages in refillable glass bottles or even refillable plastic bottles, but that's not an option. And so just as a side note, that's an example of the market not working. There are things that people want that the market isn't able to deliver, and there are specific reasons why that's the case. It's not always the case, but there are definitely instances of it, and this is one. And one of the reasons is because selling us beverages in single-use containers is far more profitable, and it facilitates the concentration of the beverage industry. And this is what happened in the 1970s when there was a phasing out of refillable beverage containers. We used to have refillable glass containers that could be reused anywhere between 20 and 40 times. And when those got phased out, you saw a massive consolidation in the beverage industry, and that was good for business. So using more and more packaging is good for business. It's good for the bottom line, like I said earlier, because we pay for that packaging, but it also accommodates a greater consolidation and streamlining of distribution, which you could say is a good thing, right? You have a streamlining. You get to do the kinds of things that Target and Walmart are doing because they buy such huge quantities that they can say to their manufacturers, we want you to package the products in this way. We want you to stop wrapping the shirts in plastic and just fold them and put them in the box. They have the clout to do that. One idea that I want to put out there is that the overall goal, you know, this is good. It reduces waste. It sounds great. But what context is that happening in, right? Because we can change our individual behavior, but what context are we changing our behavior in? What's happening in the larger social, political, economic framework? And what's happening in terms of Walmart and Target and most other companies in the United States and increasingly worldwide is that those entities are, their main goal is growth, economic growth. So yes, you have fewer shirts wrapped in plastic, but Target has to grow every year or it's not a viable company and people will stop investing in it and it won't be able to compete in the market. So these companies have to have, they need people to consume ever more quantities of stuff in order to stay viable. And that's the logic that I think is really important to interrogate. The logic of that system.
I would love to build on that, actually. I totally agree. It's about consumption, and I remember feeling so conflicted because as we see how much waste is generated by things that we consume that, you know, are in the landfill within 2 weeks, it just gets really horrifying. But then I would have discussions and people would say, but that's our economy and we don't want to do a buy nothing day, which is the day after Thanksgiving, so the avid recyclers and reusers in the world had buy nothing day instead of, you know, Black Thursday or whatever they call it, Black Friday. But yet we've got to change that paradigm. I mean, I know we want a strong economy, but we should be producing things that actually improve a quality of life instead of costing us more money. And there's a book that I would love to recommend to you, and I wish I'd read it when I was your age, because I'm a lot older now. I only read it when I was probably 45, and it's called Your Money or Your Life. And there are a couple different authors, and I can't remember the... So that's the title of several different books. It's a woman who's the chief author, two authors. Basically, it says, you know, you can spend your life working so that you can have enough money so that you can consume enough that maybe it might make you feel happy, but the time that you could be doing things that are really important to you as an individual, you have more of it if you consume less. And it's just an eye-opening book, and I bet you'll be way ahead. It causes you to change at your age than at 45. The other thing about manufacturers and what we're really trying to do is push the pressure up, back up the chain of production, because you and I as individuals can make these changes, but the real significant changes happen when the manufacturer changes what they do. Back in the early 90s, we tried to tax packaging. It was called the SCOPE Law in Minnesota, Select Committee on Packaging and the Environment, and it didn't go anywhere. There was just not the political will within the legislature to tax packaging, and it's a pretty daunting way to do it efficiently, I know. So now we're just based on just putting pressure on them. But I want to say there's like hardly anything new under the sun, because the very best possible example of reusable packaging happened in the early 20th century. Henry Ford is the perfect example, where when he bought his axles from a company for his Model T, he specified that it had to come in a box with sides of X proportions, 2 feet by 4 feet. So, of course,
they did that. They supplied it in those boxes, and then when he got his axle, he took the boxes apart and put them in the floor for the floorboards of the car. So with some thoughtful review of processes, there's lots that we can do.
You all pointed out there have been some incremental changes, and we're going in that direction of reducing. But at the same time, there's this sort of a contradiction because, you know, the economics are really at odds with too much reduction, even of packaging, which we don't think we're buying, right? But that is part of it. So I guess I wonder how, if we wanted to accelerate that process and make the economics friendlier to reducing, or at least or have it happen anyway, what are some ways to do that? What are some ways you see it happening? Would it be in the political arena, scientifically, just keep working to get a better and better, more environmentally friendly plastic bottle? Or do we need legislation to require that, you know, manufacturers use less of it?
Okay, just political is not going to work. Okay, there are examples that right in this community, Dan probably is going to hit me on the head, but is the recycling program in this community, do you think it's producing what it's supposed to do? Does what gets collected from my house, does it actually end up in something useful?
Thanks for asking.
I can read from chapter 7.
Yes. You read from chapter 7, but let me tell you about what we do in Winona County. Our materials are recycled absolutely. 15 years ago, there was a time where our plastic bottles were not able to be marketed, and that was on the front page of the Daily News. But within 2 years, the markets had evened out, and there was no cost to recycle them. And today, there's big demand for them. As you mentioned, the fleece that you like and I like so much is made out of those bottles, the polyethylene terephthalate, the PET, the number one. And so what's interesting is still in the collective memory, there are people that think that the system really isn't working, but it is. And I guess I want to say that I'm really excited about the fact that in Minnesota, this last month or two, there's been a really big improvement in our system, and that is the last piece of the process that was not as efficient as we would like it to have been, and that's glass recycling, because we couldn't separate it by color, and people who are buying the cullet, which is glass that's been through the recycling system, they want it by color. And we now have technology. We have a plant in St. Paul where all our glass goes that actually it's sorted by color by laser. So that is a really big improvement, and it's the last improvement we really needed to make it all make complete and total sense. For a while, you know, we were wondering if it really was something we wanted to consider with glass, but the problem is that once you stop, it's really hard to get it started again, so we thought there was hope, and there really was. So I've got some stats here, if we get to them, or if it makes sense, but what I want to say is that there's a lot of companies that use recycled material now. We've built a whole array of industries, and in fact, a recent study from 2011, I'm looking at the Southeast part of the U.S., there is $35 billion in annual sales of materials made from recycled, recovered materials in general, not just plastics. $35 billion a year. We have companies in St. Paul who want more material. They can't get as much. So the best thing that everyone here should do, because we have the system in place, I want you to, above all, focus on reducing and reusing. That's the top priority, top of the pyramid. But what you can't reduce and reuse, you really should be recycling, because that factory, Anchor Glass in St. Paul, told me last month that every additional 20% of cullet that they can use in their plant, cullet is that glass, every 20% recycled glass doubles their profitability.
Can I ask you about yogurt containers, number 5? Are we going to see the ability to recycle those?
You know, it's funny because you'll see manufacturers who really want to use polypropylene. And the reason they want to use that is, well, there are a number of reasons, but it's not an easily recycled material. And so what companies will sometimes do is they'll set up a system and they'll say, you can recycle that. It's recyclable. And in fact,
Whether something's technically recyclable is one question. Whether it's efficiently recycled is another. So in other words, do we have a system for recovering it and getting it rationally through the process? Number five's not so much. But this company started it, and they said, collect all your yogurt containers and send them to Boston or the East Coast, and we'll recycle them, you know. So we had an opportunity. There was a company that wanted them last year, but I wasn't really eager because they were a startup, and I was afraid they'd go out of business. But there was so much pressure because there were folks that were sending it to Boston, and it was available, so I said, okay, no promises. The company's out of business after we had last spring's collection. So there's a chance we might have some again this year, but I don't know. But again, that's a system that hasn't been developed and refined over time, so there's hope for that.
I will read something for you. This is a homework, students, so just take it for what's worth. Okay, this is from 2009. This is after they get collected, okay, up in Inver Grove Heights, right? Is
yes.
The correction,
yes.
Student?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Plastics are separated into number one and number two. Number one is PET, which has a great market. There's an infrastructure in place. This stuff is, this is not, but you know, you can buy like Patagonia and more expensive stuff, which are made up of recycled. Okay, the majority is sold to a company in Georgia that turns the plastic into fibers for carpeting and other consumer products. Okay, so this is good. We'll also separate number three to number seven, so I assume number five is in between those two. If there is a customer order, but there is typically not any market for these goods, a recycler purchases bales or bundles of sorted materials where it will be processed into consumer goods. So this is a student, I mean, this is their writing that they looked at. So maybe things have changed, but what I said is political is not enough. We need to have a sustainable, balanced solution. And it comes from different places.
So why do you say political isn't enough?
It's needed, but it's not enough. If political pressure was not here, when I came here 20 years ago, I was shocked. I came from Southeast. I was shocked that they actually collect stuff here. I don't know if they still do anything in Southeast. Okay. So it's needed, but it's not enough. There needs to be supply and demand. And this stuff is cheaper, virgin material is cheaper. The people are not going to buy recycle. If the price of oil goes higher and higher and higher, then this stuff is going to become valuable. Okay, when the price of oil is 50, 60, now it's hitting over $100. When it gets higher, okay, then we complain from one end because we have to pay for gas. But on the other hand, this becomes valuable. In general, okay, compared to glass, plastics use a lot less energy. It's a lot less energy to make this than a glass container. Price of glass will go up a lot higher than price of plastic when the price of oil goes up. Okay, think about this for a second. This is oil. This is made of oil. There's still 95% of our plastics are made of oil. Price of plastic will go up a lot less compared to price of glass when the price of oil goes up. Why? It's the energy consumption to make the container.
So if I could just jump in, the framework that you're using, the starting point that you're working from, is sort of, it naturalizes the economic system that we have. So we have the, and that's to say there are other economic and political systems out there, and ones that haven't ever existed that we could make, because we can do that. And it's not easy, but we can do that. If you look at, for example, Europe, let's just take, for example, the UK, their oil is much more expensive. And a reason for that is because their government handles it in a very different way. The way our government handles it is it massively subsidizes the oil industry. And so when it's cheaper to make a plastic bottle than a glass bottle, a large reason is because the government massively subsidizes oil. And then if you look back at the political aspect, you say politics isn't enough. For the oil sector, politics is incredibly effective because they are the most profitable and powerful industry in modern history. And what they're able to do is make sure that politicians who agree with their agenda are the ones who get elected. So for them, the political system is incredibly effective. And I think that if we can start to reorganize ourselves to make the political system more effective for us, then we'll start to make progress.
I'd like to open up the discussion to the audience and take some questions from you all.
From the audience, there was a question for Anne. What happens if someone puts something they view as recyclable in and it ends up not being recyclable? What sort of actions are taken to remove it?
It becomes a contaminant in the stream, in the recycling stream, and most of the buyers can handle about 5 to 7% contaminants. But beyond that, then the seller ends up taking a big ding on the money returned to them. So spread the word, number one and number two plastics, the milk jug and the single serving, ones and twos. So it is a problem on that end.
A follow-up question was then asked of Anne. Is there a good system which will remove the item that is not recyclable?
No, it's funny. They use water and the weight of these plastics in water to separate them from each other, but there's one, PVC, that is really hard to pull out. They can't get it out using those physics. So it is a real contaminant. It is important for everybody here to just put those in. Yeah, absolutely.
I can answer even that. Even this is contaminant. This has a blue, different type of plastic. Piece of paper, okay, glued, okay, onto this clear piece of plastic. Even if this is good, all this stuff is going to cause problems. Okay. And it's glued on. Okay. This is really stupid. Okay. And it's an example of a stupid product.
Yes. Is there someone whose job it is to remove all that, decontaminate?
No, that's the job of the person that's recycling it, to take that lid off. That's another key important piece. The label, not so much. It ends up as a contaminant, but it's just a really small percentage. So it's the caps that we really need to get taken off.
And the ring, right? There's a ring right next to it, too. Okay, you need a pair of pliers to cut through to get the ring off.
You can leave the ring on.
And these are examples of engineering that is done poorly.
Okay. Right. Well, or without something in mind, which is the recycling.
Right, and what it has in mind is keeping the product fresh for the consumer, which is good for the manufacturer, but it doesn't have in mind protecting the environment, which is good for everyone.
Which maybe goes back to incentives. What kind of incentives can we put in place to make that happen?
Okay, can I answer that? Because I do have something. I'm going to agree with Heather really strongly that I think the solution is a political one. We can put pressure on the retailers. We can put pressure on our legislators. And one example, actually there are two that I'm going to give you that I think are really important if you really want to follow through on something like this, beyond just talking to your retailer as you're checking out at the counter. And one of them is a bottle bill. We don't call it that. It's called a redemption program. Could I see one of those bottles? There is value, actually, to this. The whole recycling system for these really works. So there is value to this. It's worth it to put it in the stream. And actually, the county pays the same amount of money to our contractors to pick up 1,000 of these as we do to pick up 10,000. So just imagine the economies of scale. The cost for recycling goes way, way down the more you guys put in there, because our costs don't go up at all. Right, Minnesota doesn't have a beverage container law. There are 11 states that do now, and it's just a kind of attach of an artificial redemption value to this. And if you did 10 cents, you would recover upwards to 85% of these. That's the way to do it. You make this more valuable. A lot of these container bottle bills came in the 70s when there was a big push. For a long time, the beverage industry, which doesn't really like these because they really don't like their product at the grocery store costing more, even though you get it back, it's still a bigger outlay and they feel their sales will go down. So that's why they don't like these. They're not trying to get those recycled. I mean, that's not really their interest. As Heather said, it's their profitability. So this has to be a political solution, but there is a group in Minnesota that's working really hard on this now, and the address is www.recyclingrefund.com, and the website is about Minnesota and the bill, and you could get somebody to come down from the Twin Cities where they're really working on this, but we do need it statewide. And then the other thing I want to say is I got a call a couple weeks ago an email from a wonderful young woman who's a student here, Laura Sennenfeld, and she went to the Frozen River Film Festival and saw this video, and it just impressed her so much that she emailed me and said, I'd like to see what we can do here. How can you help me? And she's already got two more screenings set
here in the community. We talked a little bit about how she should go at this. She was going to find out if we could get a couple copies to just pass around, because, and this is for me, because I haven't seen it yet. I didn't make it to the Frozen River Film Festival, but I plan to read this, and this is another example of something you can do. So there are three things. Push, push, push wherever you can on waste reduction with manufacturers and retailers. Until we have other systems for reduction, if it comes between throwing it away and recycling it, there is just no question about the value and the importance of recycling over not, believe me. And then jump on a campaign, Laura's, or the bottle bill, the recycling refund. You know, it's funny, in Hawaii, they were the last state to adopt a recycling refund, and it was in the last decade. The way they did it, the way it worked, is they had fifth graders come to the legislature and talk about it. Not college kids, not adults, professionals. It was the kids that they found unable to say no to. So there are ways to make it happen, and I think we could make it happen here in Minnesota, but it'll take multiple years of work.
There was another question from the audience of what the cultural implications are of things like the to-go cup instead of the disposable cup. The audience member stated, "It's kind of shifting the emphasis of convenience of the product itself without the ramifications of the disposal part, and it seems to be kind of a thing that's built into our pop culture." What are your comments and thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that's a really smart question. So, yeah, this is like the latest phase. And the way that it normalizes disposability is really key, and that's something that's been happening. There's a couple things. One is the idea of convenience. And Anne mentioned this earlier, but in the research that I've done, the phasing in of disposable containers, including disposable cups, which happened, you know, kind of beginning in the 1950s, late 1940s, 1950s, and then really, you know, reaching a peak in the 1970s, and then, you know, continuing to grow since then. The story that our culture tells itself is that that was really based on consumer demand for convenience. And when I went back and looked at the numbers, what I found was that return rates for bottles, when we had refillable bottles, the return rates, it's actually hard to find numbers on those. It's been a while since I talked about this, but when deposit laws came into effect in the 1970s, they didn't just come into effect. People had to, like regular people like us in here, they got together and they said, no, we want the law to change. And they forced the politicians to make the changes to institute bottle deposit laws. And Oregon was the first state to do that. Within a year, participation rates of people taking the bottles back to the store, and this is in 1975 or 1976, participation rates were above 90%. So the next state was Vermont and on from there, and participation rates have been very high. They were high immediately. And something that indicates is that, no, people actually do want to take it back to the store. And this is a quick story about the plastic, the disposable cup, and the specifically disposable plastic cup. And the disposable plastic cup was introduced in the 1950s. And one of the first places that it was used was in like coffee vending machines. And what would happen was people would buy the coffee in a rigid plastic cup, and they would drink the coffee, and it would be so obvious to them that you could wash this thing out and reuse it, you know, so they would take it home and they would reuse it. And there was a sort of panic that ensued in the plastics industry, in the trade press, that said, we don't want people to reuse these. We want them to throw these things away because we want this stuff to be disposable. In the 1950s, the plastics industry was very clear on the way that they could grow their business, and that was to get people to understand plastic as a disposable commodity. There was a plastic conference that happened in the mid-1950s, and one of the speakers said to a bunch of plastics executives in the audience, he said, your future is in the garbage wagon. So it's very self-conscious choices that the plastics industry made. So they got freaked out when people weren't throwing this away and embarked on a mass, you know, education effort or marketing, you call it marketing, you call it public relations, to convince people that something that clearly wasn't garbage was garbage. you know? And so, and this is the type of thing that goes on today. I mean, we constantly have to be reminded and taught this. And this is just a recent example, the to-go cup. It's just another, really another phase of that.
I think we are out of time. I want to thank our panelists and thank all of you for coming.
A big thank you to Heather Rogers, Ann Morse, Farah Boris Parsi, Dave Matthews, and Elizabeth Hayes for letting us record the panel discussion. Tune in next week for our follow-up episode on Culture Click, where we have a one-on-one interview with Heather Rogers to talk more trash. You've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.